Flippers and Fire. Today we feature an exclusive, career-spanning interview with the legendary Bruce Kulick.
Welcome to Cobras and Fire. I'm your host, Luce Cannon, along with my co-host, Baco. How are you, sir?
I'm well. How are you?
Unbelievable. This last week has just been just incredible as far as just rock for me.
So I heard.
Yeah, I mean, to give you a breakdown, quick breakdown, within 48 hours on last Thursday, I got to see Sammy almost pull off a two-hour concert covering, you know, classic Zeppelin, along with obviously a Sammy solo, Van Halen, and just killing it. 67 years old at a fest called Sunfest in West Palm. And then boom, less than 48 hours, my friend Rob and I are all the way down in Key West getting away from the wives and the children for a couple days. And I interview Bruce Kulick.
You can't spell Kulick without cool.
That's damn straight. So before we get into all that, for you first-timers that are here that possibly came here from a link mentioning the new Bruce Kulick interview, just to give you a quick summary about Cobras and Fire and what it's all about, we are a rock podcast with a silly name that's dedicated to sharing, hopefully introducing you to great new bands that have the hooks, melody, and attitude of classic rock bands. We've got quite a few episodes in the archives already, even though we're a new podcast. Do you want to kind of break down a few of those, Baco?
Well, sure, yeah. I think you started the podcast with like good bands with stupid names, and then
Silly.
What kind of brought you and I together, besides Decibel Geek, was our love for Danko, and then we did a fabulous Danko Jones episode that teaches people why they need to listen to Danko.
If you were a Kiss fan, you should be a Danko fan, period. Straight up rock and roll, so get on.
Exactly. And then we did it. We, of course, we had to throw in at least one Kiss episode because we're both really big into Kiss.
Yep.
And it was good songs off of bad albums. And we did a Black is a New Black about bands with the word, abusing the word black, in a way to name themselves lazily. And then, of course, my personal favorite, and there's more, but my personal favorite is The Devil Made Us Do It, which talks about songs about Satan, the Dark Prince.
Yes.
Lord of the Left Hand.
Father of Lies.
And we're available everywhere. Go to iTunes and blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. So, so you knew I was interviewing Bruce. And
I did. But when you messaged me about it, but we haven't talked since. How did you line that up?
Well, it's kind of funny. So it was totally unplanned. In other words, I didn't go to Key West to interview Bruce. We had my buddy Rob and I, who is also on the interview with me. You know, we had this vacation plan to Key West, which if you're not familiar with Key West, it's 90 miles from Cuba. Key West is 3 square miles. It's an island. You have to take these, you're on a bridge for like 30 minutes at times. And it's actually the bridge that's featured. You're an American Male, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so you've seen True Lies. You know the ending of the movie that just has this long bridge, everything's blown up and whatnot. That's the bridge you have to take down to Key West. And it's a really unique area. But just like any time I go on vacation, I always search on Ticketmaster and just wherever to see if there's any bands that I would care to see. You do that too, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, in April I did that before we went down a couple weeks before, and it just said Grand Funk Railroad was coming to town. And again, for you first-timers coming here.
Hey, Bruce Kulick's in Brick. Hey, I see where you're going with this. Nice.
I'm glad you're following. So, you know, we are also known as the Bastard Sons of Decibel Geek. We are both writers on their website. And, you know, a couple years ago, Chris and Aaron had interviewed Bruce. So, you know, I talked to them about how they got in contact with him. I contacted him and just he said yes. And next thing you know, 48 hours after rocking out with Sammy, I'm interviewing him at the Waldorf Astoria in Key West.
Can't wait to hear it.
You have heard it.
I know. I just wanted I thought maybe the listeners didn't know, but no, it was great. I loved it. It's too bad that it wasn't in the Cobras and Fire budget to fly me down to Key West, but
no, I mean, coffee is not in your budget, and if you want to be reimbursed, tough shit. You're not getting reimbursed for coffee.
Yeah, it was great. You covered basically from the start of his career, at least, you know, professionally, you know, on the big scale, up to where he's at now. And I've heard a bunch of interviews with him. There was still some snippets that he threw out there that I hadn't heard before. And it was a really well done interview. You covered a lot of bases and kept you managed to peel some little nuggets of Bruce juiciness out of him. So
Brucey juicy. Yeah, I mean, it was just really cool experience. And just to give Bruce some props here too. I mean, super cool guy. I can totally tell that he's in a good spot with his life. He just had this vibe of just he's healthy. He has so much desire just to be a musician. I mean, you know, yeah. he's a working musician. He's touring with Grand Funk. He's working on it some you know, solo projects. And that's part of what's great about this interview too, is for the first time he's mentioning he has a new single coming out in June, and also nice. Revealed the fact that he'll give details about his work on the follow-up to his last solo album, BK3. Oh, I knew I had one thing I was forgetting. So we were slotted at 2:00 in the afternoon, and he said he only had a half hour. So, you know, we get there and right at the 30-minute mark, you know, out of respect for his time, and I don't want to keep him from anything. I just go, hey, 30 minutes are up. You want to keep going? And he goes, yeah, let's go. And then an hour went by, and then an hour and a half went by. And, you know, it got to me thinking that we must have passed is what I call the douchebag test.
Douche cannon.
Which you do call me sometimes, douche cannon. But, yeah, I mean, he must do that, which is smart, where after 30 minutes he can just bail. So if there's anybody out there that's interviewed – Bruce and he's cut you off in 30 minutes, you were a douche. You might be a douchebag. But yeah, I mean, so that was
you might be a douchebag.
You might be, because that's what made us feel great, is that he just went for an hour and a half, and he must have really liked the questions as well, because we weren't asking.
I have an alternate theory.
What?
He had an erection and couldn't leave the table.
We're going to start this over. You think that's all it was?
No, of course not. An hour long?
Oh, my God.
Seven.
Jesus. But, yeah, so the other part I'm going to mention is that, you know, during the interview, you'll see that I have little musical interludes or little clips from things that are related to what we're talking about. And part of that is just because I like putting that into the show. But also, we are in this dining room, which you'll hear a little bit of background noise. Not too bad. But, you know, we are at a resort hotel, and randomly there's a bunch of people that must have been on the beach that just love their frozen drinks. So every once in a while you hear and I didn't want to ask Bruce to redo his stories when we were just getting crushed by those sounds. So there's
that
a couple
said, don't you think Ninja's an odd name for a blender considering how loud they are?
That's definitely going to be your best joke this episode. But yeah, so you're going to hear a couple of transitions. I think there's only two where we go from, for example, we go to the exposed video to all of a sudden we just go hot in the shade. I don't know if you noticed that, but that's why, as we had to cut out chunks because of blenders. Got it?
Yep.
So anything else, Baco?
Let's get to it. Bruce!
Direct from the Waldorf Astoria in Key West, Florida on May 2nd. 2015. This is Bruce Kulick.
Welcome to Cobras and Fire. This is Loose Cannon and my co-host
Rob.
And we are in Key West on May 2nd. And we are with someone you may know named Bruce Kulick. You want the best? You got the best. The hottest guitarist in the land? Bruce Kulick!
Yeah, thank you. Certainly the hottest guitarist in Key West. It's so laid back here. I'm burning up from it, you know. It's crazy.
There you go.
But it's really, really lovely. I had no idea with all the traveling that I've done that we have this little island you know, that's 90 miles from Cuba.
Yeah.
I took a walk down towards the southernmost point. Yeah. And, you know, it's pretty interesting because it is a little bit laid back, yet you know, there's the commercialism of it being a resort. But
right.
It's, I give it two thumbs up so far.
So what I was thinking about doing is kind of starting with your whole career, kind of going back to when you played with Meatloaf.
Right.
In the beginning, and so we might be here till next Tuesday, but we'll kind of jump around
like that.
But that's kind of the structure of it. And also, we have, as hack journalists, we prepare usually by going to Wikipedia and getting a little background.
Sure.
And there's some things that may or may not be inaccurate, may not be accurate
right
there. So we're going to throw some of that at you.
Sure.
Cool?
Yeah.
All right, good. So when you were on tour with Meatloaf, did you ever see Meatloaf eat meatloaf?
We were offered meatloaf at many, many gigs. Actually, not even offered.
Was that part of the
rider? We made a point to never put it on a rider because it got very obvious. The machinery to get meatloaf known, it didn't happen automatically.
You know,
it was a struggle at first. There was money behind us to tour, and I was, of course, not on the record. That's Todd Rundgren, who produced it and played all the guitar work, who I love and have worked with at the Fantasy Camp. But my brother and I were the two lead guitarists, my brother Bob and I, and it was our goal to kind of recreate. It was a big band, nine people, you know. And
massive.
And by the time we did a few early dates, like the first one with Cheap Trick, we were booed off the stage. Okay, nobody got it.
But this was after Bat Out of Hell, wasn't it?
Well, it was. I'm talking about really the first gigs. So we were promoting the record, but no one really knew it yet.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So they see this. He was really large then. Okay, 300-pound guy in a tuxedo and a full band, and they're like, you know, screw you, we're getting off the stage.
Yeah.
You know, it was. Oh my God. You know, Meatloaf talks about it. I know. He remembers it pretty well. Anyway. A lot of money eventually was pumped into it, of course. We played the CBS convention, and I'll shorten the story to just we got all the support in the world, which meant we did a lot of radio, because back then you did break a record with radio.
Right, had to have it.
And once the record company got behind it and the radio stations played it and people responded, you can't force people to respond, but they did. There was something really incredible with Steinman's writing and Meatloaf singing and the music and Todd's production. So every radio station would show up at every gig, and then there'd be like a meet and greet, and there'd be and then invariably there'd be Meatloaf. And the disgusting part was, you know, I like Meatloaf actually, but you know they made it look like a cake because you're celebrating something. You don't bring a meatloaf to a party, right? You bring a cake, but they made it look like a cake by putting cream cheese on the top.
Oh.
Well, there's the icing.
Yeah,
disgusting.
Was it with the singles that hit? Was it Two Out of Three Ain't Bad, or was it Bat Out of Hell that finally got?
Well, Bat Out of Hell was more like the album
dashboard.
I'm pretty sure Paradise by the Dashboard Light, but it was one of those records that just was getting airplay, and I forget what the first. I actually didn't do the video because my brother and I had a recording session with a different artist. And,
okay.
And back then, well, maybe even now, whatever, you didn't really get paid to do a video. But hey, I wasn't. You know what I mean? What am I going to... You know, you pay me for the gigs, but you should pay me for that. So we didn't show up. Anyway, there was plenty of live footage that got out later on.
Sure.
And there's a live German product from Eagle Rock, I think, of that band playing. And we did a good job.
It was a good band. Lineup,
yeah.
Right?
And actually, if you buy any fairly recent CD of... or you go online with iTunes... The remastered version has an extra two live tracks, and that's my brother and I.
That's your own.
Okay,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, cool.
I think Bob's on the right, I'm on the left. And I tell you, it was a great band. I'm still in touch with some of those guys, and it's amazing to think. Without that, I'm not so sure I would have understood what it would be to be with Kiss, you know.
In a big production.
Right. Knowing an arena tour and flying and touring the world. So
yeah, right.
It was a very difficult year for me, but it was very important for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Very good initiation into it.
Yes, exactly.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the end of the story?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
that's plenty of meatloaf.
Anyway, so the next stage was with Michael Bolton, correct?
Yes.
I'll be honest with you. I love his music. I do. I'm a Michael Bolton fan. For my money, I don't know if it gets any better than when he sings When a Man Loves a Woman.
Michael was a Connecticut artist. You know, my brother knew of him before I, but I did get to play some local gigs with him.
Blackjack.
Blackjack, actually. Before I would back him in a club. He was a soul, kind of more of a blues rock artist.
Yeah.
It's interesting, his first recordings. And he worked really hard on putting together a couple of key songs that got some label interest, but they really wanted him to have a band. Hence, reaching out, actually, both to Bob and I. And Bob had some other things going on and wasn't that comfortable with that situation, and for me, I was attracted to it. So I carried on, signed a record deal for what was Blackjack.
Gotcha. So on the related to that, on the Wikipedia, and I got to read this because it's, I want to make sure I have it right. Okay, so when you were in Blackjack with Michael Bolton, when you did, like, had a great song, like a good co-write, or you just killed it on stage,
right,
to say that he allowed you 5 interrupted minutes staring into his dreamy blue eyes as a reward.
Now that you made up, come on. You know.
I got it.
Yep. He really, you know, Michael and I, you know, I saw the kind of like strength he had on stage with people,
right,
and I learned a couple of really cool things from him. Even though I thought he was kind of like a very funny and manic person, you know what I mean? I remember him being late for the audition because he had to find the right shoes. Well, there were monitors in front of the stage. You could have been barefoot. It didn't matter.
Yeah,
You know what I mean? Because you did it at one of those nice rehearsal places in New York. So there he is, literally late for the audition to buy shoes. But Michael and I, you know, kind of coming from very humble beginnings in, you know, the East Coast, he knows I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. And it was interesting, years later, I was able, obviously... He was, you know, known as a strong songwriter, and Paul was aware of him, and they knew Blackjack. In fact, I remember Kiss played on a radio station because they don't support a lot of other bands all the time, you know. But they were doing some publicity for either Lick It Up or no, the Lick It Up would have been too late. It would have been like Destroyer even or something because our record came out in '79 or whatever, something around that period of Kiss '78 to '80. He said, like, you know, like, anything you want to play, you know, and he wound up playing Blackjack.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know that actually Paul would play that. So they were aware of us. Getting Paul Stanley and Michael Bolton together was quite interesting, and they wrote a great song, of course, Forever.
And one of your best solos.
Thank you. Yeah, and I love the fact that I had that opportunity to play an acoustic solo in it.
Yep.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting for something from my past to then connect to the Kiss gig, you know, and it's still something that Michael talks about, you know, when he's performed and all, and on occasion Kiss still does it too. So. Yeah. And I obviously, whenever I try to gig in my world, I'll do that. Not Grand Funk, of course, you know, but saying when I do things related to just me. So that's kind of nice that Michael, dreamy blue eyes or not, you know, got to write Forever.
Yeah, it's a privilege.
Yep.
But okay, so with that, that's a good segue into kind of just breaking down how I got completely into a Kissaholic and obsessed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's some people who get in the 70s, etc.
Sure.
Well, I was 18 when Revenge hit the streets, and got it the first day, and then from there I started going back to checking out Motley Shade. I did the Exposed video, and that's my next question for the Exposed video. And you know, I just love the bigger than life everything and silliness of it.
Right.
Now, who cut and pasted your head?
I'm glad you noticed that.
On that cover.
Yeah. Well, you know,
why were you not there? What was the deal?
Yeah, of course, Eric Carr and myself were there. Okay, we were filming, you know, this wacky script that had very little of us in it.
Yeah.
And you have to really, you know, put your time capsule kind of hat on, you know, to know video, even that's going to come out on a VHS tape, was extremely new then and exciting. People, I can actually buy something that my favorite band did, and you know what I mean. And I think for Gene and Paul, it was like an incredible opportunity for them to showboat in front of the camera.
And they did.
Yeah. Gene already, you knew that he wanted to be in film and TV, and he started to do things predating that video. Paul, I think, certainly considered it, but I don't think he was aggressive about it as Gene. But so there you go, in a very heavy-handed way to further their own agendas, the two of them really took charge of this thing, since the money was there from the label, and this fantasy life of being a rock star was presented to the fans. I had my couple of meager lines, which were pretty funny.
Bruce! Is this the documentary?
Yes.
Edit her out. Edit her out.
Edit her out.
And there was a bevy of very hot women running around. They were all hired through some sort of agency through the, you know, people involved that knew how to film us. And,
how long did the band stay there all together in the house together?
We probably shot, and nobody lived there, of course. And they made it like it was Paul's house, although, you know, he always has had lovely homes. But, you know, if you're going to have all that commotion going on, you're not doing it in your own house, you know. But in L.A., you know, everything's make-believe anyway. So, you know, they rented a nice place.
Sure.
And they had that crazy guy with the eye that goes this way, you know. Yeah. But I think there were lots of opportunities for photos. I, of course, got the photos with Eric with the monkey. You know what I mean? And that was with my camera, you know, and they realized whoever was covering it really didn't cover enough to realize for the package it would be great to have a lot of photos.
Sure.
Okay? So I think when Gene and Paul auditioned the women, and again, they all came from like some porn agency, okay? You know, which is ridiculous. I know the girl I was chasing was some Brazilian porn star, okay?
I recognize some.
Right, there you go.
I didn't say that.
Yeah, you didn't say that. But all I know is we weren't there when that photo happened, okay? And they wanted to use it badly, so they had enough shots of, like, Eric and I. So they literally, back in then, that was a popular job, the guys who used to have to cut and paste. Yeah. It was before no Photoshop, right.
Scissors and glue.
So, and it's interesting, you do know it, but I've mentioned it lots of times when I've signed the product, because it's been on even Laserdisc and stuff. I go, you know, we were chopped in there, you know. They go, really? You know what I mean? So, they pulled it off.
Like,
okay.
Like
but it's very lame. I wish I was there; it would have been a nice shot.
Exactly.
You know? But anyway, so you are right about that, though.
All right, confirmed, 100%.
See, this guy walks into a doctor's office with a frog on his head. The frog says, "What's wrong with you?" And the doctor says, "It started with a bump on my ass." You know, I blew that one.
I did.
What did the doctor say to the frog?
Guy walks into a doctor's office with a frog on his head. The doctor says, "What's wrong with you?" The frog says, "It started with a bump on my ass."
Out of Shade.
Yes.
And that one, I know it's, I think it's underrated. I was actually talking to Buddy work about it too. I think there's some, and it's kind of funny. I read the commentaries, I guess, on your songs. And Love's a Slap in the Face has always been one of my favorite songs. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good Gene song.
You didn't realize
the
it was a drum machine
awesome.
Though, huh?
I didn't realize it was a drum machine until it got pointed out. Then I was like, how did I not know that was a drum machine?
Yeah, because you're not listening to that. You were listening to a song, and it doesn't really matter.
And it was part of it was, it's Kiss.
Yes.
Why would you have a drum machine? You know.
Well,
I
made a point about it. No, I wasn't being vicious about it. It's just, but it's the way it went down, and I know it bothered Eric, of course. But either way, it's not to ruin the enjoyment of the song. And actually, I was pleasantly surprised with Hot in the Shade after going a track by track. At the time, I was kind of like, do we really need 15 songs?
Right.
But Gene and Paul were the both producing, and they compromised by.
Right.
I'll give you this one if you give me that one. Almost, I guess. But look, there's some great stuff with Hot in the Shade, especially Hide Your Heart and Forever and even
Cadillac
Rise
Dreams.
To It and Cadillac. I didn't, Cadillac Dreams.
It's funny, because Cadillac
Silver
Dreams.
Silver Spoon, I like,
Cadillac Dreams gets, love Silver Spoon, but like Cadillac Dreams gets slogged a lot. I have no idea why.
I picked on Gene about that one.
Yeah.
I actually said to him, I really don't like this song, but I. And he goes, okay, you know, I mean, I wasn't telling him not to do it, but to me, it just seemed a little a left turn. But I think he was getting into, like, Adamant or something. Somebody,
horns in it, right?
Yeah, there was something different going on there that I didn't understand. I mean, look at his solo record when he finally put out Asshole. was very interesting.
Definitely.
Odd. I mean, I liked the tracks that Eric and I worked on with him, but the other stuff was odd, you know, so.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, look, and every record's going to have their. It's not for the artist to decide which is the good track or not, you know, and being a band in the same way that the Beatles had very varied material on every record.
Right.
And some people, I prefer the Lennon songs, or really Harrison has the best songs on this, or I love Ringo, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
So it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably too, I wanted to bring up upon the shade is, you know, that's not something that people know, you know, a lot of them, you know, every single minute of the album production. Mm-hmm. So, like, how bad was the financial situation, or the, or what was the decision, I guess, leading into, like, when you, I know that you went, you know, full out on Crazy Nights with the
right, with Neverson and everything
production, but
there wasn't a bad situation for Kiss about Hot in the Shade. What happened was there was a climate of change in the music business where doing things a little more rough and ready seemed to be more popular, okay? Mm-hmm. And I do think that once the demos started coming out good at a demo studio, they didn't want to bother to move into the fancy place, mm-hmm. you know? I can't just take a time machine back to that year and see mm-hmm. how I was feeling or what mindset exactly they were into. But they knew that it wasn't really going to sacrifice, and even the idea of keeping the drum machine instead of recutting it for Eric was solely based on it sounds good like this, we like it, you know what I mean? Is that a fair enough excuse to leave it? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like the band didn't have the money or they were trying to save the money. So I did take a little offense to... I didn't really care if we weren't in a fancier studio because I really liked the guy who ran this place.
Right.
This guy, Pat, was a great, great... Pat Reagan was a very nice guy, hard worker, very, very easy for us to be creative with. So in that way, that was I bet him also being the owner of that studio was a lot of the reason why we just stayed there.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you go somewhere else, everything changes. You know what I mean? So both of them were doing demos there. Both of them were happy with what they were getting.
Right.
This guy's getting it. All right, we used some tricks. We used some drum machines. He did some programming. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
So we just stayed that course. But to say it had anything to do with finances, no. It just had to do with... Well, we went that route, and, you know, why don't we just do this? Maybe, you know, who knows? Maybe being more rough and ready with it will make it better. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, 'cause they just kind of threw it at the wall, and it seemed a lot more true than some of the other, I mean, in the more just straight-up zone. And, well, any other stuff from that specific album that kind of...
I just thought that... we worked at it. I just was surprised that we were finishing 15, okay?
Right.
But then again, a CD can hold all that material, you know? So
exactly.
Why not?
Right.
Who knew that later they'd want to release it on vinyl again?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And back then, that was like a real teetering point. We probably put it out on vinyl, but vinyl was probably really starting to like fall off the map already. So CDs were everything in the late 80s, for sure.
I had it on tape.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Because I had the Sony... Yeah,
Walkman.
Click
right.
Yeah, the actual
Walkman. By the way, tape's coming back now. Metallica just put out that cassette. You know, go figure.
Now it's the number one cassette.
Of course. I don't think it has a lot of competition, though. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Lars wins another one.
We had a really successful tour.
Right, with For Everyone's a Hit.
Yep. Yeah. And I know then we were managed by Larry Mazur, who's still a dear friend of mine, who was involved with Cinderella and Nelson and other bands of the hair band generation.
Uh-huh. Sure,
you know.
Sure.
You know, I think it was really wise that we had Winger and Slaughter most of the time. They were getting really hot on MTV and everything.
Right.
You know. So it was a good package.
Yeah.
And that was a long tour. And I really think by the time... we needed to do Revenge. First, we were asked to do a song for a movie, you know, Bill and Ted's, the sequel to the first one.
Yep.
And that was the litmus test for Ezrin, okay? Bob had a great career, of course, with Kiss, but the first album, Destroyer, was an obvious smash that he was very influential on. The second one being The Elder, which was a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
Even though it's a good record, but it's odd. And I think they wanted to blame it more on him than everything else. I wasn't around there, so
yeah,
then, right. You know, maybe rightfully so. But either way, that one song was produced by him, and it was a remake cover, and God Gave Rock and Roll to You was an incredible track. And that, right. And that cemented Ezrin's position to produce the new record, which I was thrilled about.
Right.
He's gotten a lot of press just recently, speaking out about the record business or the industry as we know it, mm-hmm. Because it's been so decimated in many ways. So I still keep in touch with Bob, and that was a great experience. Do it. I'd prefer when Kiss is produced, even if yeah. in the end it's not your favorite record, but at least for me, I like. I know that Gene and Paul always have a point of view, and sometimes they don't always agree. So then there's sometimes compromises because of it, even though they have an amazing working relationship.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Let's not criticize that.
Right.
Look at the success. But the key here is an outside person. Isn't going to be swayed too much by yeah. that inner dynamic, you know.
Kind
and even
mediator.
If one's yeah, even if one is a little more buddy buddy with one than the other, which is usually what happens too, there's still that they're not in the band,
yeah.
You know. But that's why for me, I'll always mention Revenge as being my favorite experience with
yeah.
recording with Kiss. It was a long period of time. Ezrin gave me many many tasks and. And I knew I was dealing with like a mad professor, you know. This guy, there's no mystery that he was involved with some amazing things. He's super talented. He is a bit eccentric at times, but that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, with all great talents, there's some you know, quirks that they seem to have, you know. But I really learned a lot working with Bob. Really did.
Now, did you ever pull Gene aside during that and? You know, like on Prisoner of Love and Cadillac Dreams, which gave a little bit of feedback about the Spinal Tap reference in... No?
I'm sure he was aware of it, but
you
I don't think
he
cared.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right,
all right. And if he wasn't, I'd have, you know, we're Kiss. They, you know, so what? You know what I mean?
Hot damn, blood above. Want a lot of woman with a lot of love. Well, thin to see, but it's plain to see. It don't mean spit to me.
Revenge, like sonically, is just that I used to wear that thing out on headphones and just
great
just
record,
amazing.
Yeah.
All the guitar, that's my favorite guitar work by mm-hmm. you, just happens to be.
And there was a real point of view that the guitars would be really, you know, very vicious if necessary.
Right.
And I did do as much creatively as I could to make it memorable. I knew how to double myself, I could, you know, whatever Bob threw at me,
right?
You know, and it was almost like doing a Beatle album because I see him play around with gear the way the Beatles would experiment,
sure.
And I was like, "Why are you distorting the compressor? Check it out." You know, what I mean, I hear it by itself doesn't sound good. Then in the track, you know, that guitar part with the other one, I'm like, "That sounds great."
Yeah.
You know, again, these kind of like very creative you know, techniques to, right. To do things really, really, really special. So, again, I that was a great experience.
I have actually a follow-up to Revenge. One question, actually. Car Jam. Mm-hmm. Katarina, Car Jam's phenomenal.
Thank you.
It's just, and it's awesome. It's a great tribute to mm-hmm. Eric Carr, obviously, when he passed. On your blog, again, or on your website, mm-hmm. you talked about how you were in there the next day after Eric's.
Yeah, we flew back, and whatever the next day to work, we're back in the studio. Yeah.
What was it? That was, so it was just, we got to get this down, and it was just pressure on?
Well,
how did you kind of do it?
Once they realized that they wanted to add that to the record, because they did have those tapes, even though it was something from the past that Ace was involved in, too.
Right.
But the drum solo would be perfect as a, you know, tribute to Eric. I'm glad I didn't know the song too much in the earlier version or any remake of it. So for me, I was really fresh on it. And, you know, I'll be honest, and I think I've said it before, but it's true. You know, that was devastating for everybody, you know, emotionally. So to work and play your instruments and be creative and do something like a tribute, you know, it wasn't... That was good therapy.
Yeah,
that's good. So I did enjoy... playing the guitar. I remember it was just my old Les Paul plugged into the Marshall. There aren't a lot of, you know, crazy pedals or wacky sounds. It was very straight ahead. And I did my guitar riffs, you know, and it came out really good.
It's tight. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially for instrumental, but sometimes it can go one way or the other.
Sure, sure.
It's always awesome.
I mean, if I could think of a band, it would be like I would think Moby Dick, you know, from Zeppelin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's guitar and drums, and the drum is going to go wild, you know, so... it was great to add that to the record. That was good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that actually it was Rob and I's first concert was Revenge.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And cool. We saw you in Fort Wayne,
Indiana.
Lined up as the days of general admission shows. Mm-hmm. And
it was in the winter. It was cold. I can't remember.
That time period.
Yeah, we did tour late in the year that time.
Yeah, it was definitely cold. But like 92 to 95,
mm-hmm.
not to take away from anybody else, I think you guys were the tightest unit.
I don't disagree with that.
I bet you don't.
But look, there were a lot of great years with Eric Carr, but there was something about once we got Eric in the band, Eric Singer, and we had that Revenge record, because that was really Eric's introduction too to mm-hmm. recording with Kiss. We had this, I guess there was a new vibe and a hunger to be great, and then to celebrate some of the old material as well. We actually dug into the past a little more than I did during the other years. And Eric being a big Kiss fan, actually, by nature, Eric Singer, he went to see them, you know, when they came to Cleveland, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden we're doing, you know, like She or Watching You, know.
It's the greatest set list. Everything that was great about your era.
Right.
I want that. And then...
So I was excited to bring it up a notch. It's not like I have a favorite one, but I do most of the time... Well, if I'm trying to show somebody some arrangements from the Asylum record, it will be more likely versions live with Eric Carr. Okay.
Okay.
But the later stuff, if we're going, you know, then it's usually from a live 3 or some of the cool bootlegs that I have with Eric Singer and myself.
Right.
And there's some really, you know, great gigs that we used to do. I was very, very proud of that band. Well, live 3 kind of shows that. And so does Unplugged, you know. That was the four of us.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the special couple tracks that had the other guys, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, great band. You know, and look, it didn't come to an end because we weren't a great band. It came to an end because of that cycle of culture and the idea that...
Old is new.
Yeah. And the fact that... if they didn't do it then, I'm not sure like how much, you know, longer they could have waited. So I understood it, even though, you know, it was hard for me. But, you know, exactly. I got it.
And so that kind of segues into the fact that I told you it was the tightest, for me, mm-hmm. version of the band, is when I was waiting for Live 3 to come out, and I found out later, you know, the parts, just like a lot of the live things, are mm-hmm. cleaned up and whatnot. But I was like, why? Mm-hmm. Why would you even clean it up? Because I've seen bootleg, you know, they have the bootleg on Kistery and stuff mm-hmm. like that of the show, and it was exactly as I remember. And I think back a lot of times, I'm like, I think that was one of the best concerts I've performed, just straight. It was just great. So mm-hmm. what was the decision, I guess? There are certain tracks that I guess are all, this is only information
that's
out there.
Right.
And, you know, like, mm-hmm. I guess some tracks were just redone. In the studio.
Oh, the cleaning up. I thought you meant we did something X-rated and we were cleaning it up. Okay, now I get it.
Exposed.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be honest that I know most of my stuff didn't need to be touched up. Right. There were certain things that weren't recorded properly that needed to be looked at. Generally, we didn't have the crowd sounding as proper as we needed. Mm. And we did have a great crowd. And right. then when you're listening to the tapes and where's the crowd noise, you know what I mean? And it's right. like anemic sounding because it wasn't recorded yeah. well. You know, I love A.D. Kramer, and maybe live records aren't his thing. I mean, I don't have to, he's an amazing, you know, engineer producer. He did Hendrix and Zeppelin mm-hmm. and, of course, some Kiss stuff. But that live record, there were just some things that didn't happen right. So I know that we did need to touch up some things and put it together a bit. But I think it was done well because, you know, and I was there a lot for the mixing. I wanted to be there. Same thing for Unplugged. I wanted to be there. Yeah. And, you know, it's still, I have original tapes that it was taken to, from, rather, or meaning, I remember we recorded three shows, and I know most of it's either Indy or Cleveland, actually, what it turned out to be.
Yeah.
But these board mixes are not, you know, it's not like, it's a world of difference. Again, it's a board mix, so it doesn't have, right. you can't put out a board mix because, you know, you get the moves from the mixer. You don't really get what it right. sounds like in the crowd.
Sure.
But I don't think a lot was repaired, but I do know there was a lot of issues with the crowd noise, some of the drum things, although Eric never redid the drums. But I might have actually touched up a couple of guitar things, maybe some vocal things, some introductions maybe needed mm-hmm. to be done. But it's a long time ago, so I don't really remember.
I was just kind of shocked because yeah. of all the times I needed some cleaning up, it didn't seem like that was the
no. And I know for a fact that. And I can't swear to everything that was or wasn't done, but I right. can tell you it was less than what was done
other ones
on Live 1 and 2. And yeah. I wasn't around then, but right. I've just heard things that like, oh, yeah, we did this to that. You know, yeah. I mean, I don't even know what they did. Exactly. Although those records, they defined Kiss in that generation. So even I was, you know, like, whoa, you know, listen to this. You know, yeah. I prefer yeah. those versions to a lot of the studio stuff.
Yeah, all of the
so,
studio stuff.
So, right. you know, and anytime anyone... wants to say to me, you know, oh, I love Alive 3, and I've gotten that a lot. I never feel like guilty in the least, you know, yeah. as if like, oh, we fooled you. No, I mean, I'm always like, thanks, because I'd say 95% of what I believed I played mm-hmm. and Eric played, and even probably the bass, just maybe some of the vocal stuff was touched up,
yeah.
is from the performance, you know.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, I'm a big fan of your solo albums, too. BK3 being my favorite.
Thank you.
Happens to be the favorite. But, you know, that if I had to put my second on the list, I would say that my favorite solo album by you is Carnival of Souls.
you're cheating there because it's a Kiss album.
I know that.
Yeah,
but I know. You wrote so much
yeah,
on that.
Yeah, but again, you know, I was fortunate to be very creative in a mode that they were looking for riffs. They wanted a darker, uglier, meaner revenge. Okay,
sure. mm.
So I've told this a million times, but it's true. Well, if you like that record, you could thank me because my creativity at the time was pretty good by doing darker, uglier, meaner riffs, you know, and feeding them, you know, yeah. both Gene and Paul. But honestly, and if you hate it, but that's what they wanted.
Exactly.
Don't blame me. Okay, I mean, so I know there's a guy that just wrote my website. You know, that my merch girl will take care of. Carnival Soul is my favorite record. He's from Ireland, you know, and he's going to sure. send the album in to have me sign and ship it back. You know that yeah. that one product. I mean, you know, it costs money to ship and all that, but that's what it means to him. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And I get that. I'm proud of the record, even though I do think it could have been mixed better, but there was a lot of stress going
100%.
On there. Yeah. Toby was under a lot of grief from more Gene than Paul. Paul was already, the reunion's going to happen, so, no, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
His attention was distracted,
right.
you know. And there wasn't much I could do to save it. You know, Gene would come in there and in a heavy-handed way. Wait a minute. you know, turn up the faders, like, you know, it's like, so I think it was really hard for Toby to keep control. But anyway, the vibe of the record, it's not like it's the worst sounding album, but I just know that it could be mixed better. But I'm proud of some of it, even more than some other things, but it was an interesting time for the band.
Absolutely.
For me, imagine this. Here I am. Wow, now I got 9 co-writes on a Kiss album. Wow. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not in the band anymore. Oh, what happened? You know what I mean? So it was like I'm standing tall, and now you pulled the rug out. Right. You know what I mean? But nothing was intentional. It was
business.
It was business, and I do think that they weren't throwing me a bone by having me co-write that much. The formula for that record at that time was to have those dark riffs, and the fact that I'm the lead guitar player who was, you know, fooling around with it. I was going through a lot of personal things at the time that I was only happy when I was playing the guitar. So I'd set up my drum machine, make a beat, tune down, or whatever, and I'd come up with riffs. Yeah. So I worked hard. So that's how that happened. I Walk Alone, I can't even tell you how many versions of that song I worked on, how many demos, how many times I...
The backwards.
Yeah, worked on it, yeah. I did a million things. I didn't intend to sing the song, but I worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. And every time I'd bring it to Gene, you know, we'd make another revision, and he was really excited about it. But Toby saw that, like, no, Bruce has got to sing that. Because I sang the demo, just because I redid the demo so many times, there was no way that I could ask, here, Gene, now sing it. You know what I mean? And I didn't have the multi-track with his voice changing the backing, you know. The arrangements kept changing in a very crude way. I was quite creative, considering I'm using a Sony Pro cassette machine to my Akai 12-track to transfer over to add things.
Yeah,
wow. Then flipping the tape to do backwards things and grabbing that and placing it in. I'm not cutting things. I'm just like, you know, I was doing crazy things, but not impossible to recreate once we got to the big studio, fortunately. Okay. And it actually even surpassed my expectations, you know, with what I was able to help create. Because that was, like, for me, you know, a tip of the hat to Hendrix and Queen and bands like that.
Sure.
And Gene was, I was very, very impressed how creative he wanted to get to with it, you know. So it was a good experience for me. And I don't mind that it was, like, the only song I sang in Kiss, and my last statement in Kiss. It was a very fitting
idea. Yeah.
And I don't belong, can't you see? I walk alone, let me be everything I've dreamed of. Me is me. And I've got myself to lean on, I got both my feet on the ground.
So they just recently had on Decibel Geek they do this thing called Albums Unleashed, where they sit down with a producer.
Right.
And they actually had Toby Wright there.
Okay, yeah. And, you know, I didn't follow all that, and I've had a couple people tell me.
Okay.
I have to listen to that. I saved the info.
Yeah.
Because I know he talks about the Carnival Souls a lot in depth, right?
He does, but his, and I'm supposed to ask you this if you had a better recollection, his recollection is kind of, I just heard the song again, now I remember about this, and
things like
that.
That's why I got to listen.
Yeah.
He might spark some memories for me, too. Yeah.
So, but his vibe was, or his memory was, that when the call came in, that, you know, we're getting the band back together and everything within the studio, that they basically left you to kind of finish it, I think was kind of the vibe.
Well,
you had so much involvement in it that it was like, we got to start this.
Well, at a certain point, that's like half true.
Okay.
And I don't think it was intentional. It's just they kept it real quiet. They were negotiating with Ace and Peter's representatives by the end of MTV, probably even during the actual making of MTV, because even though I don't know this as a fact, it's pretty clear when I add up all the pieces of the puzzle, is that yeah, Ace and Peter wanted to do a reunion tour badly and weren't going to be so agreeable about Unplugged, which MTV was insisting on having Ace and Peter involved, unless they were able to make a decision that how could they make that a reality, meaning to actually tour in makeup and do that. And once everything was ironed out, which was not easy, okay, and again, completely, I'm in the dark, okay, so is Eric Singer, but they want to make that happen because there's big money on the stakes, the people that are trying to make it happen. MTV is going to get the score of Unplugged with the reunion, and then here you go, everybody can, like Star Wars, relive something, you know, after it's been gone all those years, you know. So by the time that they were willing to talk to Eric and I and explain what was going to happen, we were a little more than halfway, almost three quarters done with the record.
Gotcha.
So the meat and potatoes of the record, we were all there. Everybody was doing their job. Nobody was thinking about the reunion tour. They may have had some phone calls on break, or they may have had contracts on their desks back at their homes, okay? Once that was, the beans were spilled, as they say, and we have our conversation, which I totally got. There was a commitment and money spent to record a record, so it's not like we're stopping the record because of a reunion tour. But yeah, their focus, because they had a lot to deal with, because now they knew it was full tilt. Okay, see, full tilt. Yeah, full Kiss tilt. Is going to put on the makeup. That's the lovely kitchen staff here at the at the beautiful Waldorf Astoria in Key West. Anyway, at that point, I mean, really, there was probably just lead stuff left and maybe some vocal things and the finishing touches of the record and then the mixes.
Right.
Of course I was going to be there.
Yeah.
You know, and if it meant both of them weren't there, we carried on because Gene trusted me and so did Paul. And, yeah, Paul was bringing, oh, let me see if the boots fit. You know, and he's trying them on at the studio. You know what I mean? I'm kind of like,
brought them in.
You know, I'm like, but, you know, look, I was supportive because they weren't, you know, saying, all right, in 2 weeks your paycheck ends. You know what I mean? They were very clear that they were going to take care of Eric and I for a year. And really, they didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, obviously, once they put tickets on sale and started selling out, but what if Ace or Peter went, you know, completely rogue?
Yeah.
Then what do they have?
Yep.
So they knew to keep this thing, you know, kind of like solid and still have Eric and I as you know, something that they can fall back on if they had to, which was smart of them, and obviously a better cushion for me and Eric, so that we can get into the next, you know, phase of our careers, you know.
Yeah.
So I can't really take all that credit. It's just I was there, and certainly up until that point, Gene and Paul were dedicated. After that, it got a little bit distracting.
Right.
And I think for Toby, even though he got it too, who can blame them to try this, you know, and they were right because it became hugely successful. But, you know, the focus wasn't quite the same.
Right.
That changed.
Yeah.
Did it take time after, you know, when you're like, let go, I guess, you know, that we're going to go in this direction to, like, process the entire experience and been like, well, that was that, and now I've got to move on. I kind of,
to be honest, I always feared the reunion because I knew Ace and Peter would have loved to be in the band.
Right.
So for me, it wasn't as shocking as it was for Eric. Eric Singer didn't think Peter could play. And he was wrong because Peter didn't do horribly at all.
Yeah.
You know? So for me, I was kind of always in the back of my mind. I was shocked I got 12 years out of it, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
Right. So it wasn't too much of a shock, but I knew that I'd have to start from the bottom again, in a sense, which is what I did with John Corabi with Union.
So let's go into your solo albums.
Mm-hmm.
If you could kind of break down, because I know Rob has less of a threshold for instrumentals, but I like instrumentals in general, but
I try to keep it melodic, the instrumentals.
That's what I'm saying. Like, what is the art of, because I love Paradise and Monster Island.
Right.
What's the art of not making an instrumental?
Well, there's
you know what I mean?
Yeah, too much of a wank fest, okay?
Correct. Yep.
Look at me, look at me, look at me. That's a riff. Yeah, Eric sings that very well. Anyway, I'll give you just the backstory on the three records, because they all have an evolution of myself, okay? Audio Dog, by the time Union ended, I realized I want to do a solo record, you know. I mean, it's not so much that we all, like, broke up the band. It's just we hit that wall where we didn't know what we could do, mm-hmm. you know, because we just did it all. And I had a lot of leftover material that I showed Kiss that I didn't get to. I mean, Old Man Wise for Union was something left over from Gene and I, okay? Yeah.
I just want to jump in. Well, how did you get connected to Kurt?
And Kurt Cuomo was someone I met through...
There's so many songs.
Right. Kurt, I met through Paul Stanley because Kurt and Paul wrote some things when Paul was, you know, kind of dabbling in just being, like, writing songs. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily for Kiss, you know, right. to have, like, a catalog because that was very popular then and there were publishing deals and sure. people that would put you together with different people. And somehow Kurt and him got along and that's how I met him. And I got involved with Kurt. I asked Kurt to help out with the Union record, you know. And then past that, I realized the first solo record, obviously Kurt could help me too. So I recorded it at his studio. But that all the material from that started with stuff in the closet that were left over. I remember Gene liking this music, but we never developed it. You know what I mean? Yeah. What do I do with it?
Yeah, right.
And then a few of them were obvious that I wanted to be able to sing. And some were just like, I hear a melody for this. This could be my way of doing a Joe Satriani. No, I'm not Joe Satriani. He's even more. He's really technically amazing, but still,
yeah.
Give it a theme thing, you know, and then you know play fancy things. And so I didn't have a formula, but I did have an instinct as to what song should be instrumental and what song do I have to sing. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was being brave coming out. I realized, well, I sang "I Walk Alone," and you know. I think nobody complained. The Kiss fans reacted, so I'll sing some of these, you know. So yeah. So then I moved forward and started to write more lyric things, and I was proud of Audio Dog. I think it was a great reflection of me having this attitude. If I have to sell it from the trunk of my car, that's what I used to say. Little did I know that DIY kind of thing was really the future of business.
Stage at that point.
Yeah, and I didn't look for a record deal. I didn't ask anybody to help. I funded it myself. Recorded it with Kurt, started printing 1,000, another 1,000, another 1,000. I probably sold close to 10,000 of that thing through those years, which was amazing.
That's on the website.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I did distribute it to some. There were more of that back then mm-hmm. in 2001 than there is now. But that's what I did.
Okay.
Transformer, I realized, 2 years went by and I'm busy with Grand Funk, traveling all around America, and I'm just like, let me write this, you know. And I just started writing the lyrics on the planes, keep me busy. I knew I could sing this, you know, whatever. And I pushed myself again to get in the studio. That one I asked John to sing a song on.
Yep.
And there's Transformer. Okay. By the time I was finished with that is when I met this young guy, Jeremy Rubolino, who's actually related to Ezrin, who was a huge Kiss fan that I knew. He worked with Brett Michaels and a few other people in L.A. and a young guy at the time. And he wanted to get involved with Transformer, but I was already, you know, like getting ready to master it or whatever. Okay. So I said, well, when I'm ready to start writing again, we'll get together. So I started working on with him on BK3. Now, I didn't know it would take us like 4 years to write it and put it out. But
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I started actually writing songs in 06. Took that long.
Wow.
But there was a whole process with it, and the touring and the working, you know, prevented. And then we cut some things that we didn't finish. Excuse me. One of those actually wound up on iTunes, you know, as the bonus track. Okay. I did get to finish it about a year ago when I put it up there. But BK3, he was pushing me to reach out to other people, you know, mm-hmm. like... I didn't have to trick Gene. It was very natural. Even Eric said, you should ask Gene. And then Gene's like throwing Nick at me, you know, his son, you know.
Yeah.
So there was a really long, non-methodical process to creating the special guests,
sure.
you know, to go beyond just having my buddy John sing a song. So all of a sudden you have a Doug Feiger from The Knack, and then Tobias Sammet from, mm-hmm. you know, these famous German band, Ed Guy and Avantasia, and then... Steve Lukather to jam solos with me on the one instrumental, okay? Mm-hmm. So, it was a real process. And I like that it was an evolution to it. My biggest challenge now is like, and I'll just throw a title out there, it doesn't mean I'm going to call it BK4, but thinking of the fourth solo record, what am I going to do? Is it going to be more of the same, or is it going to be a complete left turn? I don't know yet. I know I have some material that I really love that I do want to finish, that I feel could be, you know, a start of a record, you know, sure. And there's plenty of other songs on my iPhone that I've recorded that I know there's a song there, and I just got to get to work.
Right.
But the only breaks I put on it was putting the vinyl out was obviously a big deal, okay? It took a while to have it manufactured, and the artwork was a pleasure, of course, with the same guy who did it for me on the Digipak. And I only started shipping it like 2 weeks ago. And it's been crazy, actually, you know, because there was a huge flurry of orders. It's doing great, and I'm very proud of it. And sonically, I was thrilled when I got the test pressing. And I'm hoping in the future I could do vinyl for the other product, too, you know. But the other news that's also interesting that's kept me from having the time. Look, a trip to Australia takes months to arrange, but then you're gone for 2 weeks, you know, and then I'm back on the road with Grand Funk, and then I'm selling the BK3. And now I've been doing a lot of stuff regarding this other project called KKB. It's my first band. I was 20. We weren't called anything, but we rehearsed our asses off and recorded some very progressive Cream meets Yes, I call it, kind of material. My buddy Mike, who I grew up with on in Jackson Heights, where I lived then in Queens, wrote the majority of the songs and sang, and he plays incredible bass, got a great rock voice. And I did put out a limited run when I first found the tape, okay, back in 2008. The joy of re-releasing it in 2015 is the fact that he found the original tapes, so now we can really remix them properly.
Okay.
They're at the right speed, they're at a higher quality, and now I can give it a little more effect, that it sounds much more professional. But then I wouldn't do that without, we got to write a new song. So the idea of a new song was like a big chore. So many trials and tribulations later, killer new song called Got to Get Back, and that will be the title of the record, because I like that it's kind of related to the fact that I'm getting back to putting out something from 40 years, but now in a better way than I did the first time.
Yeah.
Because the first time was literally, I even showed it on the packaging when I did this limited run in 2008, only for my website. You know, there was a picture of the realistic audio tape, which is like Radio Shack. By the way, the stuff wasn't on Radio Shack tape. It was on better tape than that. But my copy was on Radio Shack. Yeah. And when I mean, Mike knew that I was releasing it back then. And I said to him, I said, do you have the tapes? Do you have anything? No, I can't find anything. Well, last year he found everything. You see what I mean? Actually, next week, it's exciting. I'll be ordering them. I decided to do, again, a limited edition. Okay. And I'm going to add in, I just ordered the picks, they're on their way, guitar pick, you know.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And then I'm looking at, I'm not 100% yet, but I'm looking at a download card, so that this way they're also getting that opportunity to put it on their computer, put it, they don't have to burn it themselves.
Yeah.
Even though I think my fans love physical, but it is going to be a 6-panel, gatefold, digipack kind of thing. And I'm looking at a photo card, because I really would like a little them to have a souvenir from it too. And then the flip side would be the real story of why KKB needs to be released in 75. You know, I mean, the discovery of the tapes, you know, the new song. And what's really funny about the new song is, first of all, I love it. And all my friends that have heard it freak over it. But it's just, it sounds like maybe from 40 years ago. That's what's weird. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to put yourself in a little time capsule.
I mean, the production, too.
Yeah. I played the demo for Fred Corey because I wanted him to help with some of the drum programming before we sent it to Guy over in France. And Fred, you know, Cinderella drummer, now he writes for TV shows and stuff, and we're good friends. And he got all confused. He got that KKB was 40 years old, but he didn't get that that was a new song.
Yeah.
So when we finally had the conversation about what I wanted him to do, he goes like, all right, so this song I got, man, it's cool, 40 years old, huh? It sounds great, 40 years ago, wow. And I'm going, no, that's a new song, but I need you to listen to some of the other ones, you know what I mean, just so he had a reference point, you know. No, come on, Bruce. That song's 40 years old. You know what I mean? He was insisting to me that we didn't just write it this year, you know. So anyway, it's going to be a great package, a limited run. It will be on my website. I'm finally excited about it. And I'll put it up on iTunes, too. Why not?
Sure.
Even though I don't know. You see, the game with all that, with iTunes and Spotify and Pandora, is once you go through one of the companies that does it, like TuneCore, CD Baby, and people like that.
Right.
Then you're able to have them serve it everywhere. Because right now, if you don't have that, we all know that streaming pays poop.
Right.
I still support buying music. I have to learn classic rock band stuff all the time for the Fantasy Camp.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Pat Travers is the guest. you know, I know some of the Pat Travis songs. Do I own any of it? No. I go to iTunes, I listen, I go like, this is good. Click, buy the greatest hits, buy the packet, whatever. And now I have it.
Yeah.
Is it vinyl? No. Did it break the bank? No. But that's what's unbelievable. People will go, yeah, I'll check out your BK3. And then the fan's listening on iTunes. He's listening on YouTube.
That's the worst. I know.
Thank you. I'm very impressed with what my engineer friend, Brian, who worked on BK3-2, did to these vintage tapes. It sounds killer. And I'm excited about that. So hopefully that, I'll guess that by June, that should be ready.
She's running, she hides, but you got to get back. She's running, she hides, but you got to get back, and get back, and get back, and get back.
I don't want to even begin a conversation about the 99 things that are wrong with the record industry right now. It has changed. Everything's changed. How would you like to be a photographer nowadays compared to 25, 30 years ago?
A million photographers. Anybody that has a camera is a wedding photographer.
And now people enjoy a concert. I realize anytime I play live, if I stink. Fortunately, I have a good quality control engineering in my brain, and I generally play well. But you get what I mean. You know, everyone's filming everything, and you're going to see it.
An off night. Yeah.
Look, I had a great night Wednesday in Hollywood jamming at Lucky Strike, which is a very happening thing. Yeah, and you get to experience that. Believe me, being there live is nothing like that, and I really enjoyed it. I had, you know, the guys learned the songs just the way I wanted them, and I had a blast. You can tell.
Yeah.
But the fact that I could share that with the world, those are the amazing things about the internet. Yep. You know what I mean?
But at the same time, what I always do is I'm like, put down your phone, enjoy the...
Yeah, yeah, be there in the moment. Exactly.
The other reason I would never do it is somebody out there is filming it for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I know.
And it's going to be better. It's going to be better.
Yeah. No, it's always, you know, I always have to, like, edit anytime I see something too live that I'm like, no, don't use your phone. Take it in right now. You know, and I remember the first time I had my good iPhone, I was at a Seal concert in Argentina. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. It was in Chile, in Santiago. I ran into the band flying from Argentina to Chile, and the guitar player was a big Kiss fan and knew of me, and we kind of made friends, and next thing I know, I'm front row to see Seal. You know, it was great, and I like Seal. And I'm like standing, you know, there I was, that was years ago already, you know, so I was really guilty. I was probably four years
ago. What am I doing? Wait a minute.
But it was great. And then he's like singing right to me. There's nothing you can do. I know there's artists like the Eagles that have complained about it and come out vocally about it, but I realize there's nothing you can do about it.
I went to I'm not a big fan of this band at all, but I went to a Tool concert and they actually cannot take your phone out.
They don't want
you. They actually have security. Yep. I was like, it's kind of a jerk move. I'm like, this is a brilliant move.
Yeah. And that band, you remember their videos, you didn't see them really.
No.
It was always these creatures.
No.
So maybe they have a concept of how they want you to enjoy their music, you know.
I guess. But it was nice to not be blocked.
Yeah.
Is all.
Well, I'm glad I got to tell you about the KKB thing. Absolutely. And BK3 Vinyl. And, you know, my website and the Facebook is always strong. And my dates for the Grand Funk live gigs are always up on my site too.
Yep.
Because a lot of people get confused with the Grand Funk site, even though all the dates are there, it's just they don't realize you got to go to the right and hit the scroll button. You know, I've had some really smart people go like, "I only see one date." No, that's the first date of the year. That's just whatever. You know what I mean?
More.
You know?
That's how we're here. I know how to use our website.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. That's right. Yeah, you figured it out. Good.
Well, listen, anything else you want to mention? We really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. I knew I'd go longer than our 30 minutes, but I love hearing myself talk. No. I do want everybody to be supportive of the bands they like. You know, that's important because, you know, even the people that record in their bedroom, and I don't, okay, I like to go to a real studio. But it takes effort, and there's talented people that to do it right and to make the kind of music the way you're used to hearing it is a whole not only creative but a physical kind of, process and, yeah. and these good studios with the $10,000 mic right. that makes it sound really pro is important, you know what I mean, for the music. Right. So that's why I just want people to support their band's product.
Really appreciate your time today.
No problem.
Over the course of, more than half my life, I've listened to between Kiss and Union and your solo stuff. It's when you're down in the dumps, I just listen to some of that stuff.
Excellent.
It brings me up.
It's a lifestyle for you. That's good.
It's a lifestyle.
Well, like the Beatles are a lifestyle.
It's a pack of dogs.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. But enjoy Key West here.
Thank you.
The limited time you have, I'm sure. Go down Duval
and enjoy. Street.
And if you want, you can borrow my scooter.
yeah, that's fine.
Our hogs.
That's right. Thanks, Bruce.
All right, you're welcome.
Thank you, Bruce.